If only Edward Chadwick by Louis Bass. Louis Bass lives in London. He is presently engaged, both in England and India, in extensive research into the life of Major A.W. Chadwick, Sadhu Arunachala. Part 3. I sit with him here. As I lived onwards, I found that almost every photograph had an inscription of some kind. Some of these seemed quite superfluous. Above one picture, he had written, "A disciple." Above a picture of Bhagwan as a young man, he had taken the trouble to write, "The Maharishi as a young man." Anyone who read the book would have had no need of these little explanations. So, he again seemed to be working on the assumption that his parents wouldn't bother. But other inscriptions were more revealing. Above a picture of Bhagwan and Lakshmi, he had helpfully written, "The sacred cow of the ashram," and it was impossible not to wonder how talk of sacred cows would have gone down in 30s England. Below this is a picture of the old hall. The inscription is smudged, as if someone had nodded off while reading the book in the bath, but it is just about possible to make out. This is the room where the Maharishi sits for meditation. I sit with him here too, with the other disciples. How strange that his readers might not have instantly recognized the famous old hall, and that they might have imagined their son went there for private meditation sessions with this strange Maharishi. Above a picture of the Arunachaleswara temple, he had written, "The eastern gate of the marvelously beautiful temple to which I go each evening for meditation at the shrine of Krishna." So presumably his routine had been to visit the temple early in the evening, then return to the ashram later and end the day in the vital presence of the Maharishi. This seems to be confirmed by the very last inscription. The picture shows the entrance of the ashram, which, if it weren't for the familiar archway, would be quite unrecognizable to visitors of today. No cars or lorries are visible, no auto rickshaws or motorcyclists swerving by with mobile phones crooked to the ears, no backpackers or ignorant Westerners like myself wandering around with a slightly bemused air as they wonder at exactly which point they are supposed to remove their shoes. There are only two white-clad figures in the foreground whose stance somehow conveys the entrancing peace of the place. One stares away to the left as if he has been distracted by the distant creaking of a bullock cart, whilst the other looks towards us. No doubt it was still a rare thing to see anyone actually taking a photograph. The archway itself seems to have appeared by a forest path in the middle of nowhere. There isn't even a wall on either side, so that it looks slightly surreal, like a checkpoint marking a non-existent border. Why bother having an archway at all when anyone can just walk around it? And there is no apparent difference between this side of it and that. But of course, this is no ordinary threshold. It is a magic portal, like the door of an enchanter's castle or the shore of Prosperous Island. If it seems to serve no apparent purpose, that is because this is a dream archway and the domain it protects is not visible to the waking eye. Things may look and feel exactly the same act you have stepped underneath, but in fact you will have passed through the looking glass. From then on, you may at any moment suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. A mystery devotee had drawn an arrow through the arch next to which he had simply written, "I walk along here each evening." I was left feeling that the whole thing was just a sort of glorified postcard, even if his family could never understand Bhagavan or his philosophy. This Englishman abroad wanted to make sure that they formed at least some idea of the exotic place in which he was living. He wanted them to know what it was like to meditate in the temple each evening, then to walk back through the magic arch and settle down with the other victims of the enchantment at the feet of that strange Indian, Prospero. But he could surely have had no conception of how much he would be revealing to another English reader far away in some fantasy future of space stations and microchips. All unknowingly, he had told me much about his relations with his family, his life in India, and his devotion to Bhagavan. I felt I knew him now, and even though he would never understand it himself that we were friends, I also had the strange sense that I was the intended recipient of this book. It might have passed through many hands, but the fact that it had ultimately washed up in the great jumble sale of eBay and in such awful condition proved that it had never been treasured at its true worth. It had been smudged with dirty fingers, exposed to rain or bath water, and unceremoniously used as a coffee mat. Only now, after who knew what other trials and indignities, had it finally arrived in the hands and the home of someone who could understand its true value. It was impossible not to feel that, some 75 years after it had been posted from Thiruvannamalai, the book had finally reached its destination. All of which gave me the absurd but inescapable feeling that my destiny was somehow linked with that of the mystery devotee. This in turn made me more eager than ever to find out exactly who he had been, because if fate had really chosen to connect us, the revelation of his identity would also reveal something about my own. As soon as I had finished leafing through the book, I drove up to show it to my sister, a fellow devotee who lives nearby. We did our best to take some professional-looking photographs of it to put up on the internet. I then came home, uploaded the pictures, and sent the link to a few people I knew would be interested. Soon enough, the emails were flying back and forth between England, America, and India as we tried to work out who the mystery devotee might have been. And the first name on everyone's lips was Chadwick's. Now, I don't mind admitting that I had hoped it would be he. If my destiny was to be linked with anyone's, I could think of nobody I would rather it be than Chadwick. From the moment I had seen the date the book had been sent back from India, I had secretly longed for it to be his, and I am sure that most devotees in my position would have felt the same. All of us have a soft spot for Chadwick. All of the impressive, extraordinary, and inspiring figures who were drawn to Bhagavan, I can think of no other who so cries out to have the words "good old" placed before his name. Good old Osborne somehow doesn't come so naturally. As for people like Ganapati Muni and Muruganar, the very idea of putting those words before their names is somehow so incongruous and disrespectful that I don't think I could ever do it, even as a joke. Good old Chadwick, on the other hand, seems not only natural, but somehow inevitable. If I try to think what might have happened if I had met Arthur Osborne, I can imagine us hitting it off in a way, perhaps with me struggling to keep up my end of a highbrow discussion of theology or comparative religion. In the case of Ganapati Muni, I would have been too awestruck to have opened my mouth, and in the case of Muruganar, I think I would have been too overwhelmed by admiration and love. But I can easily imagine myself pumping Chadwick's hand, giving him a hearty slap on the back and saying something like, "Good old Chadwick, I have heard so much about you, my dear chap. What a great pleasure to shake your hand at last." Then, possibly over tea and crumpets, we would settle down to a long discussion of the paths that had brought us both to Bhagwan, and how wonderful he was, and what miraculous changes he had wrought in us both. We would part as the best of friends, with me feeling I had known the dear fellow for years. Never leave the knowledge of yourself, for you will know me in yourself. Do you know, daughter, who you are and who I am? If you know these two things, you have beatitude in your grasp. You are she who is not, and I am who is. Was it not I myself, hidden in your heart's core? O fire ever blazing, the soul who comes to know herself in you finds your greatness wherever she turns, even in the tiniest things, in people and in all created things. God says, if anyone should ask me what this soul is, I would say, she is another me, made so by the union of love. Catherine of Siena.